Today we will start with an informational meeting, the overview of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and its relationship to the Oregon State Hospital. And our first witness is Mary Claire Buckley. And Bob, did you want to come up with Mary Claire and Bob Nickel?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I thank you for this opportunity to provide you with some information about the board for those members who are not as familiar with the PSRB as others. To this end, I have provided you with a packet of information that I'll be referring to in the course of my presentation, which includes an article that was written when the board received the American Psychiatric Association's Gold Achievement Award in 1994, which, although the numbers and some of the dollar figures in that are obviously dated, I think still provides an excellent overview of the board's operations and organization, and so would be, you know, beneficial in explaining just how the board operates. In addition, I have provided you a sheet with the listed statutory functions of the board, a sheet that outlines the types of hearings the board has and the time frames within which the board has to hold those hearings, and then some graphs and charts related to the board's current population and its current situation, and gives you basically a snapshot of the clientele and where they are at this point, and maps of the state with county designations as to where clients are committed from, the courts, the county of commitment, and also the number of persons on conditional release in each county as of yesterday. To give those who are not as familiar with the board some background, the Psychiatric Security Review Board was created by the 1977 legislature as a unique experiment to deal with the problems that were inherent and apparent in the system that was in effect at that time that dealt with insanity acquittees. It was established as a separate state agency, independent of the mental health and criminal justice systems, but with responsibility for assuming the jurisdiction over all persons who were found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, as the defense was known at that time. It was set up and continues to be a 5-member, part-time, multidisciplinary board. The membership is comprised by statute of a psychiatrist and psychologist who are experienced in the criminal justice system, an attorney who's experienced in criminal trial practice, a parole or probation officer, and a member of the general public. The enabling statutes direct the board to have as its primary concern the protection of society. The statutes also set forth the board's other duties that are outlined on one of those sheets that I provided to you. To give you an idea of the organizational aspect, I will tell you that the board's budget solely pays for the administrative costs of the board's work, that is, the staff to run the daily operations and to hold the hearings. The funding for both the actual treatment and supervision of our clients is contained in the DHS, or Department of Human Services, Office of Mental Health budget, both for hospitalization at Oregon State Hospital and the community treatment and supervision when our clients are released. And I think Bob Nickel will expound on that aspect of the system in a few minutes. The board's clients, by definition, suffer from a mental disease or defect, which, when active, causes them to pose a substantial danger to others. They are placed under the board by a trial court after successfully asserting the insanity defense. The length of jurisdiction is equal to the maximum sentence, statutory sentence, they could have received had they been found guilty of the crime. Sentencing guidelines do not apply to this population. There are currently 715 persons under the board's jurisdiction today. of which 293 are on conditional release status, and of those, 283 are in various communities throughout this state, as illustrated on the map that I provided you. Most are indigent, as their only source of income when they're outside an institution or hospital is either Social Security income or Social Security disability. Schizophrenia is the predominant diagnosis. The majority have a history of alcohol and drug abuse as well. About 96% of our clients are under the board for felony offenses, and a substantial majority of those involve serious person felonies such as assault, arson, homicide. The board's mission is to protect the public through the ongoing review of the progress of these clients and to make a determination of the appropriate placement of these individuals, be it in continued commitment at the state hospital, on conditional release, which is a status of structured living in the community under a monitored program, or outright discharge if they no longer meet the legal criteria. These determinations are made through a hearings process. Three of the five board members sit as a panel to hear a variety of types of cases, and those two are listed on that sheet regarding hearings. The client is entitled to an attorney and is afforded other due process rights as well in these hearings, including the right to testify, the right to subpoena witnesses, and the right to appeal any adverse decision to the Court of Appeals. The state is represented by the Attorney General's office. At each hearing, the board must decide whether, in fact, the individual continues to suffer from a mental disease or defect and continues to pose a substantial danger to others. Both of those elements must be met in order for the board to maintain jurisdiction. Otherwise, the statute requires the board to discharge the person. Conditional release is granted upon completion of a comprehensive process, which initially begins with an assessment by the interdisciplinary team at the hospital, in which they determine that the person is ready for community release. They approach the board, basically, and ask for the board's permission to pursue conditional release planning with a community provider. At that point, the board would order an evaluation by a county mental health agency, which makes an independent assessment as to whether, in fact, they agree with the hospital's readiness assessment. And then, if, in fact, they agree that the person is ready for release, would also submit to the board a plan that includes the conditions by which they would have the client abide if they were to be released to their supervision. Then that plan must come before the board and be reviewed and approved as to all of those conditions. The board works in concert with the Office of Mental Health and community mental health agencies and their case managers and other providers to assure appropriate supports and treatment services, as well as supervision, are available to its clients outside the hospital. If a client is approved for conditional release, then the second and equally important aspect of the PSRB program is triggered, that is, the monitoring of clients in the community. Case managers are assigned and required to file reports with the board on a monthly basis and to call at any time the conditions of release are either violated or the person's mental health status appears to be decompensating or deteriorating. Such a change in mental status or a violation of the release order can result in the issuance of a revocation order. This order constitutes sufficient warrant for police to take a client into custody and return them to the state hospital. This entire process from report to rehospitalization may be accomplished in just a few hours. Currently, with the 293 on conditional release, we are averaging about 6 revocations a month. The board, however, does not necessarily consider a revocation to be a failure, unless, of course, it involves some criminal activity. Oftentimes we will have the need to return somebody to the hospital because they are in need of some medication adjustment or some stabilization that can't occur in the community. The board does look for, you know, given the census at the hospital, the board does first pursue community options for increased treatment, but at times it is necessary to have these individuals return to the inpatient program at the state hospital. It is the combination of the protection of the public while balancing the rights of the individual and the opportunity for conditional release with prompt revocation if necessary, which makes the PSRB the successful program it is. Its success is evidenced by the extraordinarily low recidivism rate, which we use the same definition as the Department of Correction as the commission of a new felony offense while on release. Since the board began keeping performance measures in 1992, its rate is about 2%. This compares to DOC's rate of 30 to 35%. For the current biennium, the figures were 0% for 2003 and 1.4% for 2004, which involved one incident out of 72 revocations. However, despite the board's success, it is still facing some major issues that impact not only this agency, but also the state hospital, as I'm sure you're aware, the community providers, and the forensic system as a whole. First and foremost is its tremendous growth in population. As you can see from the charts that I've provided to you, in years past, we averaged somewhere between, 50 or 60 new clients. It started to creep up in the late 90s, and as you can see, in 2002, we had 78. Then, in 2003, it took a huge jump to 110 new clients, and in 2004, we received 126 new clients. You can also see from the next chart that along with these new cases, we are not seeing as many discharges or lapses as in previous. From that new client versus discharge chart, you can see that back in the early 90s and all the way, almost through 98, the board received a certain number and discharged about the same number, so our total population remained somewhat stable. That is, that 60 came in and 55 went out, and the net gain was not substantial. However, again, since 2003 and 2004, you can see that for 2004, with the gain of 126 new clients, we only figuratively lost. We didn't lose them, but they left our jurisdiction either because their time ran out or they were given an optional discharge. We only lost 57. So there has been a net gain just in the past calendar year of, 59. And same for 2003, we had a net gain of almost 60 clients. So that's why we've gone quickly from a population of somewhere in the 500s to 715 today. You'll see from the next chart that we continue to get clients for the serious felonies. Once again, 96% are for felony offenses. And the last graph will show you that this pattern does not seem to be abating. For the next 4 years, we're projecting, just based on persons who would lapse by operation of law, the most we're going to lose in the next 4 years is 50 clients, and yet if we continue to get 100 or more clients a year, we'll be having a net gain each year of another 50 or more clients. So we clearly have our work cut out for us. As you can see, also, I provided a chart which gives you an outline of exactly
where these clients are.
Out of the 715, 293 are on the conditional release, as I said. 10 are out of state or out of the country, but 283 are here in 20 different counties of Oregon in various residential sites, and that there are currently 398 of our clients in Oregon State Hospital. To be clear, this information is not given to you to complain. In fact, the board does not see this as a bad thing in and of itself. Clearly, it is better to have mentally ill offenders who qualify for the defense placed in our system rather than the Department of Corrections. However, the ramifications it has with regard to overcrowding at Oregon State Hospital and issues for community providers cannot be ignored. And I'm sure that Bob will give you the latest number of persons over census at the hospital as of today. But further, of that figure, of the 398 that we currently have in the hospital under the board, a number of those individuals have already been determined by the board to be appropriate for placement in the community, and yet there are no adequate placements currently available. Because, as I noted, the way the system was developed, the much of the responsibility for the development of community resources was placed with the Department of Human Services and particularly with Office of Mental Health. As noted earlier, the office is the one that has the budget for the care and treatment of these folks, both in the hospital and out. Clearly, in the past, the state has not kept pace with this growing forensic population in developing the necessary supports and services, including residences, for those deemed ready for conditional release. However, I will say that at this point, we are now engaged in a rather large collaborative effort with our partners, including the hospital, the office, the community mental health agencies, and others, in developing new placements for this population. And I can say that during this biennium, probably more new placements have been developed than in any previous biennium. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Bob to expound on that a little bit.
Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back to your snapshot of January 17th. The last column entry is 24 other, and it says Department of Corrections or AWOL.
Oh, I'm sorry. They're on escape status.
And can you tell us, of those 24, how many are actually in escape status versus how many are in Department of Corrections?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, I believe that it's currently two in the Department of Corrections, and the 22 on escape status will be since the time the board was created. We have carried it over. When the board was initially created, we were supposed to assume jurisdiction over all persons who had previously been found not guilty by reason of sanity, and some couldn't be found. So it's not that these are all current cases, but
Yet
about 22 is from the time the board was created in 1978.
Thanks for the clarification and for the record.
Thank you, Senator Pruszynski. That was very helpful. Other questions?
Yes.
Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Brudick, is there a relationship, you believe, between the increase in use of methamphetamines in the state and the striking increase in population that use your services?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I would say yes. I mean, I don't have any data or statistics to provide you with today, but anecdotally I would say that we are seeing a number of clients who have been affected by substance-induced psychoses, of which methamphetamine is a primary one. And I don't know if Bob has more data on that.
Just segue here. Are there other questions? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator of the Department of Health and Human Services, or Health Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, also known as OMAS. And I'll try not to slip into any acronyms. But
we don't have fines in this committee. We observe Article 1, Section 8 in this committee.
Thank you. I will still, for the sake of clarity, try to speak as plain English as I can. I appreciate the opportunity to give a brief overview of the relationship between the services that are provided to the PSRB. So obviously the state hospital is the primary service provider for people entering the PSRB system. As Mary Claire has stated, and we've placed on the record numerous times, we are over our budgeted capacity. We are under our licensed capacity. I want to make that clear. We have not exceeded the licensed capacity of Oregon State Hospital. But the budgeted capacity is almost as important. And today we are 56 forensic patients over our budgeted capacity. That's nearly two wards worth. It's a significant issue, something that we've been working at very hard to maintain an orderly treatment environment, a safe treatment environment. I think for the most part we've done a fairly good job of that, but it's a great challenge, particularly for the staff and the patients who live in these kind of situations. We also, as Mary Claire mentioned, have created a record number of community placements this biennium, but as you can also see by doing the math, the dramatic increase over the last several years of people entering the PSRB system and the need to keep them in a safe and secure treatment environment for long enough that the board is actually comfortable and able to release them to the community in a safe way, that means longer lengths of stay, and that's in large part, in a macro sense, what's driving this census problem. I think rather than go through extraordinary detail, I think the important things to remember are that once people are adequately treated and the community is ready to take them and the Psychiatric Security Review Board approves them for conditional release, they do go to the community. And I think it is one of the clearly the most successful programs. If you look at it from a recidivist standpoint, it's pretty hard to argue with these kind of results of a 0% recidivism rate 1 year and 1.4%, which probably represents, I think, as you said, one person. The community mental health programs obviously play a critical role. Community mental health programs are not required to take any particular patient back to their home community. In fact, many times it's really best that the person, particularly if they committed a high-profile crime, really should go to another community. And what we do is try to work with the county mental health programs so that they're willing to take people from other communities just in the same way that they would probably prefer not to have certain people come back to their community for fairly obvious reasons. I think over the last couple of years, the county mental health programs have really come to the plate and worked very well with us. They are working under limitations. Funding is really not so much the limitation here. There's a total of, if I did the calculation right, about $1.5 million per year that's spent on the monitoring process for making sure that the case managers monitor PSRB patients and they fill out the forms and they're really there to make sure that if any problems come up, they deal with that. In addition to that, there are the treatment costs. We don't separate the treatment costs. We could probably do that through a detailed analysis, but the idea is really for people to fit back into the communities the best they can. So we really try to consider them as we would other patients in the community mental health system, except for the monitoring and the safety issues that are involved. One of the policy decisions that we made a while back was for those people who are Medicaid eligible, we chose not to put them into managed care under the Oregon Health Plan. They still get fee-for-service Medicaid capability for the treatment services that they require under the conditional release agreement and whatever other services they require. But we did not want to place managed care organizations or the board or the community into any kind of situation where they're so concerned about the costs that they don't do what's best treatment-wise or safety-wise for these patients. So for the Medicaid eligible who might otherwise be in a managed care environment, if they're under the PSRB, we take them out and deal with them on a fee-for-service basis. I don't have the exact figures, but I believe about half of the PSRB patients in the community are Medicaid eligible. The others are not, and so we have to use full unmatched state general fund to support the treatment and the monitoring costs for those patients. I think as Mary Claire indicated, we prefer to take people into the community into 24-hour supervised care when they come out of the state hospital. There are occasionally exceptions to that, but we've really tried to make sure that they don't leave one environment and get into a less restrictive environment where they're really not prepared for that. So as a general rule, we try to take people into to residential programs.
So you don't go too far beyond this. What are the factors that determine whether someone is of your population is Medicaid eligible or not? Maybe you said it and I dismissed it.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, thank you for the question. Whether they're Medicaid eligible depends on whether they've gone through the Social Security determination process and have been determined to be eligible because of a disability, or if they're lucky enough to be OHP standard eligible, they could fit into that category as well.
I see.
But basically, it's a matter of them having gone through the Social Security process sufficient that they are viewed by the Social Security Administration as eligible for disability payments.
And do you have a process for helping people go through that process to get more of them?
Madam Chair, you're correct. We do have a process. Most of that happens in the state hospital, but for those patients who are discharged to the community and they're not yet Social Security eligible, we will, if we think that they are eligible for that potentially, we will have the case managers work that process through.
Okay. Thank you.
I think the strengths of the system are, as I mentioned, the treatment and monitoring and the way that we've set it up in collaboration with the board and the community programs and the state hospital is a very successful program. Treatment really does work for this population. I think the second real strength is the county mental health programs. Even though they're not required to take people, for the most part have stepped to the plate. Mary Claire mentioned that 20 20 of the 32 county programs that we contract with. So it's probably a few more counties than that if we actually looked at the actual counties involved, but 20 of the 32 counties have taken people in. Thank you. For those counties that have not done that, we are entering into discussions with them to help them understand that it's really a matter of fairness, not only to some of the people from their community that they'd be allowed to come back or that they help out with other communities, because they send people and if they're not taking anybody back, then there's kind of a fairness equity issue here, and we're having that discussion with several of the county mental health programs now. I think the challenges that I wanted to mention were one of the really key things is when we try to develop additional community placements for those people who are ready, work intensive process. In other words, to set up a residential program takes quite a bit of work with potential providers, often with the neighborhoods, with city licensing and zoning requirements, working with our office to make sure that the funds are going to be adequate to do the job that needs to be done. And frankly, I think we have probably not given the counties enough money to do the kind of development work. So in spite of that, as I said before, they've done a record number of community developments, but that sometimes slows us down in terms of creating the kind of community resources for people who are ready to go. I think the other problem that we run into, not nearly all the time, but occasionally, is just the process of citing programs in the community. It sometimes raises questions about whether people are safe, and we understand that we need to work with communities and counties on those kinds of issues. We really do try to work with them, though, to help them understand that this has been a very successful program. We don't place anybody out there that we're not comfortable placing out there, and we monitor very carefully everyone who's there in the way that Mary Claire has described. Finally, I think I'd just like to mention that the role that the state hospital has is obviously to treat and to help provide information to the board about when they feel that patients are ready to go. And then my office, the central office for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, play a policy role in working with the board. We play a program development role. We have staff who are working very, very diligently on trying to create new programs. We have the funding available. We work with the programs from a regulatory perspective, and also we do a great deal of liaisoning back and forth between the state hospital and the communities and the PSRB. I think that probably covers the overall points that I wanted to make, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Great. Thank you. This has been very, very useful. Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 39 and Senate Bill 41. Same witnesses.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name, again, for the record, is Mary Claire Buckley, and I am the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I appear as the proponent of Senate Bills 39 and 41. The purpose, well, as you can see from, Senate Bill 39 was to require the court, the trial court, to determine on the record what mental disease or defect was in effect to which the defendant relied upon in getting a guilty except for insanity verdict. And Senate Bill 41 was asking or was requesting that the defendant be required to have a psychiatric or psychological evaluation between the time of the offense and the time of trial so that we could have current information about these individuals. I will tell you that the overarching reasoning for these bills was the concern that has been raised as you've seen from the statistics I have provided. With the tremendous growth in the clientele of the board, there have been some questions in some minds as to whether, in fact, all the individuals that have been recently placed under the board are appropriate and whether those judicial determinations, actually these individuals suffered from a mental disease or a defect sufficient for board jurisdiction. And so all three of these bills were crafted to try and address that issue and to assure not only the hospital and the Department of Human Services, but the public that, in fact, only individuals who met the legal criteria were going to be placed under the board. However, given that there are some concerns that have been voiced by the ACLU, OCDLA, the Judicial Department, and the Office of Indigent Defense, it would be our request that both of these bills be sent to a work group for further discussion and deliberation with our partners before proceeding with these, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think after talking to some of the parties who have an interest in this, I think that's a good suggestion. So perhaps we could ask a work group formed of you and Mr. Nickel and people from the defense lawyers bar and ACLU and Nancy Miller back there to whatever involvement you want to have. You could do that and then come back to the committee.
Sure. Madam Chair, I will also mention, however, that part of the motivation for this also is to respond to some opinion or at least dicta in some recent Court of Appeals decisions regarding the PSRB as well. And so there was some criticism in those decisions about the lack of the citing of a mental disease or defect for purposes of their review later. And so that was another of the impetus for bringing these bills. So we'll address both of those.
That's good. And I think it's all a matter of how you do it
absolutely
than the objective. So thank you very much. I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 39 and 41 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 40. Maybe we could have a brief description from counsel on Senate Bill 40.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 40 would exclude from the legal definition of mental disease or defect the disorder of paraphilia. Currently, the definition of mental disease or defect within the ORS states that it only excludes personality disorders. Generally, the practice has been that Axis 1 diagnoses major mental health diagnoses do fit within the definition of mental disease or defect. This bill would change that definition to add another exclusion from that definition. In other words, in addition to personality disorders being excluded, the disorder of paraphilia, at least when the individual solely was diagnosed with paraphilia, would not be sufficient to constitute a mental disease or defect sufficient to assert the insanity defense.
Thank you. And you both are signed up to testify, so I'll let you decide who should go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and appear to testify on behalf of this bill and ask for the committee's support. I think council has outlined very well what exactly we're trying to do. This, once again, ties into our efforts to assure that only persons who are appropriate to the board's jurisdiction are placed under its jurisdiction. This would actually codify the recent holding in the Court of Appeals decision in Beiswinger versus PSRB, which was not addressed by the Oregon Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago because, in fact, this case had become moot as a result of his lapsing from discharge. So the Supreme Court isn't going to be addressing whether, in fact, this particular disorder would be excluded from.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krasinski.
Can we get some more clarification on it? Did the court choose not to do it because it's no longer before them?
Yeah.
In the sense of that they actually had it before them and they chose to not go forward?
Madam Chair, Senator Krasinski, the matter was dismissed prior to this Supreme Court argument because the client's jurisdiction had lapsed.
But they had, in fact, accepted review of the matter before they dismissed.
Madam Chair, Senator Krasinski, yes.
Thanks.
So basically we're asking to add, as you note in the statute, mental disease or defect isn't defined so much as it has exclusions, and we would just add this exclusion of paraphilia, which is a broader category, not just paraphilia, but aparaphilia, which includes, as counsel has noted, a number of other diagnoses, including pedophilia, from the use of the insanity defense. I think that that most psychiatric testimony would have indicates that that they do not feel it is an appropriate diagnosis for our jurisdiction. And I think Mr. Nickel.
So do you have anybody in your caseload now who do have these diagnoses?
Madam Chair, I did a review of individuals with the diagnoses just yesterday, and in fact this would affect only two individuals under the board's jurisdiction, and they have been placed under the jurisdiction years and years ago. But obviously this, they would remain with us because this bill, we would ask that, I think this, I meant to ask you that, that we would have, we neglected and would ask that an amendment be added to have this effective, an emergency clause, so this would be effective upon signing as opposed to waiting, so that it would go into effect as soon as possible. But those two individuals obviously wouldn't be affected by this, but it, I think, illustrates that this is not, you know, a major issue for the board. But once again, in light of the continuing growth of the board, we want to assure all that the appropriate clients are placed under our jurisdiction.
Okay. And why again do you feel like you need an emergency clause on this?
Madam Chair, the board would, and I believe the Office of Mental Health and the State Hospital would just like to have these this bill put into effect as soon as possible so that we will not be receiving any of these individuals as soon as possible, basically.
I do. If I can just follow up on the two individuals that are under your jurisdiction, I understand the reason for the emergency clause is to keep new cases from coming in. So the two that are there, why would they not be impacted? Are they also under the jurisdiction for other reasons besides what this bill would address.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, it was my understanding that this would affect cases only arising after this date of the bill's effective date, so that individuals placed under the board prior to the effective date would not be affected.
Okay. I appreciate the explanation. I'm just not sure if it actually is going to hold up, because once it's in place, what's going to stop someone from a petitioning for being released if they would say at this point, if I had committed this offense and had come basically through the courts, I would not be under the PSVR jurisdiction today. And so I'm not sure what your legal counsel has said, but you may want to make certain that's what the intent of this would be. And
Brzezinski will do that. It was my understanding that they were considering it prospective, not retroactive. So, but we can check with our counsel.
That's a good point. Okay. Let's see. Okay, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 40. Excuse me. I'm getting ahead of myself. We will reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 40 to take our second witness. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Bob Nickel, Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I just want to go on record as being in support of Senate Bill 40. I think the key thing for us is that even if it's a very small number, patients who come into the hospital with this as their only diagnosis, it's very difficult for a hospital that no longer provides a sex offender treatment program, as you all probably remember, closed down with legislative direction several biennia ago. It's a very difficult situation to have a person in the hospital whose only problem is this paraphilia, and we really are not very well prepared to treat that. So, and given the census issues, it would really make sense to us to have this one excluded.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who'd like to speak on this bill, and any questions from the committee? Did you have a question, Senator Starr?
I did.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The how to phrase it, that's the question. Passage of this bill then excludes this as a defense from for those individuals who are being adjudicated, that they cannot claim this as a defense as being insane or having mental defect. Is that going to be an outcome of this passage?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes. It is our intent that a person with solely a paraphilia diagnosis would not be a sufficient mental disease or defect for purposes of asserting and successfully asserting the insanity defense, and therefore not come under the board.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brzezinski.
And just to follow up on what Senator Starr said, based on that, that would mean that those individuals would stand for trial, and then if they were convicted, they'd go into the penal system and not being referred to the board for supervision.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, yes.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Any other questions? Any other witnesses who would like to testify on this? Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 40. And I think we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 40. Are people pretty comfortable with this? Open a work session on Senate Bill 40.
Madam Chair, do you want to make a motion?
I would love it, Senator Walker.
Make a motion to move Senate Bill 40 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Move Senate Bill 40 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I understand that the witnesses did, in fact, want to consider an emergency clause. I assume that what we're going to do is move the bill and allow them to address that on the House side. And if it comes back across, we can concur at that time.
That would be correct. I don't see a any objection to an emergency clause, and it may be, it may be good to have a vehicle for considering a number of them together. So, is there any other discussion? All right, any objection? So ordered. Senate Bill 40 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, and I would like to ask Senator Whitsitt to carry this bill.
Thank you.
Wonderful experience for you.
Goodbye.
Okay.
Goodbye. Your first bill?
We haven't.
Okay. Oh, I'm sure I'll get to you.
Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 204.
Council.
Just summarize it and then we'll call it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 204 adds a mental state to the crime of simulating legal process. This offense is currently on the books at ORS 162.355. It's a Class C felony. It's currently defined as follows. It's when a person knowingly issues or delivers to another person any document that falsely simulates civil or criminal process. There are several definitions of criminal or civil process. They're open-ended. This bill would change the statute, adding the mental state that specifically would require the prosecution to prove that the simulated legal process was committed not only knowingly by the actor, but also with a specific intent to harass, defraud, or injure another person.
Thank you. Dina Vitolins. Did I pronounce it right?
Chair Burdick, Dina Vitolins.
Dina Vitolins. Well, I'm close.
Yes.
Anyway, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Dina Vitolins. I'm an Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Criminal Justice Division. We're asking that you amend the statute simulating legal process to insert the requirement that individual have a culpable mental state in order to be convicted of the crime. We've had several challenges. Basically, simulating legal process is used. We prosecute individuals who harass or file false paperwork against judges, district attorneys, police officers for when those officials are simply doing their official functions. For instance, a district attorney will file an information against an individual. They will then respond by trying to record a lien on that district attorney's personal property. And so that's what we use in order to stop that kind of behavior. The thing that we figured out is that potentially if I were to serve a subpoena on my friend to attend my birthday party, I could be charged with simulating legal process. And we think inserting the culpable mental element will stop a potential finding by the appellate courts that the statute is unconstitutional.
Thank you. And have you had cases come forward to the courts on this?
Yes, we've had three challenges. We were successful in the trial court in defeating those challenges, but we're not at all certain what's going to happen at the appellate court.
Okay, so this is trying to get ahead of it and make sure that it stands constitutional muster. Okay, are there any questions from the committee on this? Seems pretty straightforward.
Thank you.
Any other people who would like to comment on this? Thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 204 and open a work session on Senate Bill 204. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 204 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 204 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Okay, so ordered. Senate Bill 204 is sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And I will carry that. Okay, I think that completes our agenda for the Senate Judiciary. Unless you correct me, Council, I seem to be...
Come on, let's go more. You got more.
So we now adjourn the Senate Judiciary.